thanks for having me back. It's been a better week for me this week, yay, than the last time I taught. So this was a difficult passage, and I wasn't supposed to have this passage originally. And then Courtney said, hey, can you switch? And I said, sure, but before I, but that was before I looked at the topic. Great for me. Yeah, we were just, you know, kind of talking in the meeting before, just, these are hard topics, and we got government, slavery, politics, all that kind of stuff, submission, so hope y'all are awake, but this is really just, I'm just going to kind of take it down a notch to just kind of simplify it, that this is really a continuance of what Kara talked about last week, that we're sojourners and exiles, and we have been asked to live in such a way among the Gentiles that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits. So that was like the last two verses in the section before this. So we're continuing the theme this week of how new converts to Christianity live in exile where others may not share their faith or beliefs or maybe even hostile to it. So I felt like the government piece was a little bit more straightforward, self-explanatory. So I'm really just going to jump to the section on slaves and masters because I think that's really even the most helpful for us in our own personal walk with God. I want to start by saying that this passage in no way condones slavery, says it's okay, and I know that's probably, like, obvious, but I just want to say it anyways, that I'm not saying it condones slavery. Peter is speaking to believers in that time and trying to encourage them in their situation, which some of them were enslaved. So how do we look at this passage then? If these people were in slavery, how do we look at this passage? Well, first, let's look at who the slave was at that time. And I think that will enlighten us to what this passage is saying for us today. So it's interesting, as I was reading, that the slave was the most vulnerable in the Greco-Roman society. They didn't have power. They didn't have social status. They didn't have a voice. And really, they were, like I said, vulnerable because they have no one standing up for them. And it's really interesting in the translated to the Greek that, from the Greek, that Peter is actually addressing the slaves and the wives later on in this chapter directly. And I took that as personally. This was actually uncommon in this time for Greek writing. Because it would normally be like, well, you need to tell the slaves and the wives, for example, what I'm saying. But he's actually saying, dear slaves, essentially, or dear wives. So can you imagine, like, if you haven't had a voice and you've been in a low social position, or you feeling like just so powerless? And there comes a letter circulating from the Apostle Peter, and he's directly and personally addressing you in your lowly situation. I think that would have meant a lot to me. Let's see here. These slaves were called because, okay, so if we look at the text, the slaves were asked to endure suffering and submit to their masters, and that they were going to follow Christ as an example. So Christ suffered for you, leaving you as an example so that you might follow in his steps. So this is kind of strange. Like, so these slaves are asked to follow Jesus' example in suffering. Well, it turns out that example here is not really the proper translation also. There's not, I guess, like an English word that really translates what it was that Peter was trying to say. But what he was trying to say is that the word example here is really more like a pattern, an idea, or a paradigm. So if you read it again, Christ also suffered for you, leaving you a new paradigm that you might follow in his steps. Leaving you a new pattern that you might follow in his steps. Leaving you a new idea that you might follow in his steps. That word example, it's also hard to use that word. I was reading some things that Tim Keller had written about this. And he's like, if we think that we have to follow Christ's example in this, that's really discouraging. Because that would mean that I would have to be sinless in the situation, and I would have to die as a slave under unjust circumstances, even though I didn't deserve that. And it's not really possible for us to follow that example. And actually, Christianity is like the only religion that you don't have to just follow the religion leader's example to be blessed. Like, you know, other religions might say we need to be like Muhammad or be like Buddha or that kind of thing. And so it's not saying you have to be like Jesus and that he was perfect and he was a perfect sufferer, you know, all that kind of stuff. He's saying follow his example of how he suffered, if that makes sense. So, that he was speaking directly to these slaves that were under these masters. But in a few verses before that, in the passage that you just read about the government, it says that we are all slaves of God. I don't know if you remember that, but it says, live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. So then it just, like, really widens the scope for us, because it's not just saying slaves live in a new paradigm with how you would follow Christ in the situation, but he's connecting that we are all servants of God. We're all essentially slaves, if that makes sense. Not slaves to sin or slaves to earthly masters, but that we're servants of God. And so what does it look like then to live as a servant of God with all of these things that you might experience? So these other Christians that may not have been slaves at the time still were experiencing persecution. And they might have, because of like the emperor and all these other things, they might have lost their social status because they were following Christ. They might have felt less in power because they were following Christ. And then, even jumping to today, you know, we might be feeling all those same things that they were experiencing at the time. It may not even be because of our faith, but some of those things definitely are because of our faith. I mean, I don't feel like I experienced that level of persecution here, but I'm sure that some of you today are, like, you know, social status. Like, you know, you would like more money, or you would, you know, like to be in a certain neighborhood, or maybe you have felt like people have said things unfairly about you. Maybe you have felt like, you know, you just feel like you're in a powerless situation, like you're out of control. And so we can also relate our situation to today to what these Christians were going through and say, I'm a servant of God. I'm a servant of God. How will my paradigm for suffering under such conditions also change the way that I approach my suffering. So I would like to look at what does it mean to follow Christ in this pattern of suffering? So I think one of the main things is that Christ realized the greater purpose in his suffering. So, talking about Peter, we look at the story right after in the Garden of Gethsemane, right before Jesus is taken off. Well, when he's being arrested, essentially, the passage says, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his ear." So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So we read in this passage about Jesus, he did not retaliate. He did not threaten. Why did he not retaliate? Why did he not threaten? Because he realized that there was a greater purpose in his suffering. And so that was our salvation. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. That's right there in 1 Peter 2. That was part of his suffering, is that he went through this so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. So he had something else in mind. So the question for us also becomes, what is the eternal goal that God could have in my suffering? What redemptive work might he be doing in my unjust suffering? This is so hard, right? When you're like really in the thick of it. But he says that this suffering is actually, a few verses, the will of God. And it's for the Lord's sake. So these, once you start connecting these dots of this new paradigm, it makes sense. Like, wait, my suffering is the will of God? And it's for the Lord's sake that I'm supposed to submit? Like, what does that mean? Well, it also means that he has another purpose. And it might be glorifying him. It might be, like, leading, like, you know, it says that others may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits. We don't know what those reasons may be. And, you know, we may not ever know until Jesus returns. But he's asking us to follow and trust that when we endure these hard things, that God has a purpose in it. And that seems trite. I know, like, you know, you don't want people to say, and it's really not the best thing to say to people, you know, that are experiencing a tragedy. Like, oh, well, God will work all this out for good, you know? But we can be in them with it and say, this is so hard, and we don't know why. And cry together, because it doesn't mean, even though you know there might be a greater purpose, that it doesn't hurt, or that you don't grieve about it, or you're not experiencing anguish about it. So a second point about what does it mean to follow Christ in this pattern of suffering, and I'm sorry I don't have a handout for you guys. I typed this out, and I lost my first document, and then I typed the rest of it out in Gmail as my Word document. My word processor, and I emailed it to Abby Ainsworth last night and asked her to print it out for me this morning. So, this is part of God had something for me in this. The second part about this is that Jesus entrusted himself. Abby, you're my second talk. My second time, like, referenced. He entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Again, like a really hard concept, but here, just that Christ had such a relationship with the Father. He knew his heart. He knew that the Father loved him. And he knew that the Father loved, you know, all the people that Christ would die for. And he knew that he was all-knowing and knew that he knew best. And so, this is why Peter asks, the slaves at that time to submit, that God's got this. And what I was reading is that those harsh masters and husbands will be held accountable to God. It's not like, you know, they're getting away with it, which feels like it at the time, right? And so that was part of Christ saying that my Father is the ultimate judge. And remember how 2 weeks ago when I spoke and Peter's asking them to consider God their Father and an impartial judge? This is why they needed it again, to hear it, is that you're going to go under all this unjust stuff, and he's your Father, but he's also a judge. And we need to remember that he's in control and that he will punish those that need to be punished. Deuteronomy 32, 35 through 36, God's talking, says, "Vengeance is mine and recompense for the time when their foot shall slip. For the day of their calamity is at hand and their doom comes swiftly. For the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants." Look, there's the word again, servant, slave. "When he sees that their power is gone and there is none remaining, bond or free." So there it is. I mean, for those that are feeling powerless, for those servants, for those that have, that are going through the suffering, God will vindicate them. He will take vengeance upon the people that hurt his people. And I think that there's comfort in that. So, these are hard concepts, like I said, that Christ realized there was a greater purpose and that he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. But I also think that he went through these things so that he would be able to relate to us in our suffering. And so, just speaking to you guys today, like, he knows. He knows those things that are going on in your life right now that you feel like you may not have a voice, or you feel like it's not going to work out, or you feel powerless. He knows, and he's been there. Again, this is great on paper, but doing it is another thing. So I really wanted to share this hope with you as I close, that there's actually grace for you who are enduring unjust suffering. Grace especially rests on those who are undergoing injustice. Grace is given to those who act righteously under injustice. So in 1 Peter, one in chapter 4 and the other one in chapter 5 in closing, it says, "If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you." So what that's saying is, first, those undergoing insults have the Spirit of God and glory resting on them. That's his grace. But furthermore, it says that at the end, by Salvanius, "A faithful brother as I regard him, I have written you briefly to you, exhorting and declaring that this is the true grace of God." So grace is all among this that, I'm going to read those two statements I read earlier, that grace rests on those that are undergoing injustice, but also those that are undergoing the injustice are given grace to act righteously in that injustice. Does that make sense? So they're getting blessed by grace in that moment because they're undergoing such suffering. But they're also given grace, like a grace sandwich, to respond righteously, because we can't follow Christ's example, but we can follow the paradigm that he's showing us how to live by. And God's saying, but you don't have to do this on your own. I've got you. And I think that we have to enjoy his grace in that, and enjoy that his Spirit is resting on us, and that he's with us in that, because he's not asking us to do this alone. Finally, just one thought is that if you are undergoing unjust suffering or abuse or anything like that, I know that a lot of those things are hidden in our homes. You do not have to go through that alone. And if you are being asked to sin, then we're not, that this passage is not saying that you should submit to sinning, if that makes sense. So that's like the caveat here, is that if there's some kind of sin going on that you're being asked to do or asked to be a part of, then you have the biblical responsibility to say no, and to maybe involve the church in that. So again, I said slavery is not okay, but I also think that I don't want, if you're feeling powerless, to not have a voice if you're being asked to do something that is sinning. And this is, I think, where community comes in too, that we can, without gossiping, maybe take, you know, one or two people aside and say, what do you think about this? How should I respond in this situation? Can you pray for me about this? Because these, I mean, everyone's situation's different than, so we just have to use discernment with that.